to the RTE Rugby Podcast. We're into the thick of the first international window of the season. One game down for Ireland, beaten 26-13 by New Zealand in Chicago. Plenty of talking points to get through from that game after a disappointing outing for Ireland. And we've had a few days to digest it all, so three more games to come as well, and opportunities to right some of those wrongs. Japan, Australia and South Africa across the next three Saturdays. All of those games live on RT2 and RT Player. Bernard Jackman is with me in the studio and Johnny Murphy's on the line. And first things first, Bernard, we'll get to talking about how much you enjoyed your Chicago trip. Don't worry. But we do actually have some news overnight to sink into straight away. Tadhg Byrne has been cleared to play after his red card against the All Blacks was rescinded, deemed not to reach the red card threshold. He obviously got a 20-minute red card at the time. It was a yellow card upgraded to red by the foul play review officer. It was a pretty black and white one in the end. I struggled to find a single person who thought that should have been upgraded to a red card.
Yeah, and
many people who thought it shouldn't have been a yellow.
Yeah, I was in comms with Justin Marshall, and straight away we thought, well, penalty, but that was potentially not even a yellow. We thought, and then we were absolutely shocked when we heard in the ref mic that it'd been upgraded to a red card. I felt, I don't know how Dan Jones came to that decision. Like whatever, about a referee making a decision on the spot under pressure, he had so long to think about it and look at it, and I think it's the right decision by World Rugby. He's actually down to be our foul play TMO for South Africa and Australia, so I don't know if that'll change. But yeah, it was a, thank God, I'm against 20-minute red cards. Mm-hmm. Okay, because I think a red card should be a red card, but absolutely, when it's a blatantly wrong one like that, it does at least save the game. But I don't think that, I think we should trust the officials to be able to make the right decision. Obviously, on this occasion, it was a wrong decision. And it didn't really affect the game, except the fact that Tadhg Byrne, our best player, was gone. But I think the way the game played out, it was hard. Ireland weren't as good as they would have needed to beat the All Blacks.
Johnny, Byrne made the point there on the 20-minute red card. And I actually would have I'm against the 20-minute red card as well. I would actually have a slight fear that this is the example people will use of the 20-minute red card being a good thing, because it wasn't the ultimate punishment for a team to lose a player for the entire game after 14 minutes, but kind of ignoring the fact that it shouldn't have been a red card to begin with. I don't think you can kind of put those two things together and say, oh, look, the 20-minute red card is there in case of mistakes.
Yeah, 100%. I think it's a bit of a get out of jail free card for any of the, you know, the decision makers, the referee decision makers. So it's, it's a tough one. I actually thought there and then, and I've spoken about this before, I do think that like poor technique could, you know, should be penalized and should be a bit of a line in the sand there. But then when you analyze it over time, you know, Barr comes out and says what he says. You look at kind of that incident, the incident then where, you know, slow mo makes it look way worse than it is. It's a forward pass, and I think, look, the right decision was reached overnight, but like it's just a bit of a shocker, to be honest. I just think that I think the referee should be able to make that decision in play in that moment really quickly there, rather than kind of, you know, slowing it down frame by frame when you know, slow motion. Just obviously it's clear then that if you look at it slow motion wise, it is letter of the law, you know, shoulder contact to the head. He's upright. It was just looking at it, I think it's just a poor, it's overall just a poor look from everything from Saturday the whole way to Tuesday.
So I think the referee had a very poor game in general, and he's a pretty average referee. I watched a lot of him in the top 14, but to be fair to him, I think the fact that the big screen didn't work.
Yeah, I actually had a lot of sympathy for him.
So, like you can imagine, that's 5 minutes into the game, a game with huge expectation.
Two minutes into the game.
Sorry, yeah, it was 5 minutes by the time we got to look at the when he went into the dugout to look at a small screen. But like you can imagine, how that pressure was building on him, the frustration, not knowing what has been seen by the TMO, because obviously I think he missed it live, like the referee missed it live. Mm-hmm. It was just a rugby incident. Like the reason,
and also like from his point of view, the TMO was kind of leading him down the garden path, talking about how big of an impact there was in the moment, and you know there was force in it and
sure.
stuff like that.
And then obviously he goes in, he's crouched over a screen in, beside the dugout. So I feel sorry for him, but I think from a World Rugby point of view, and this isn't just this game, but I think that recently we've seen referees depowered, okay, and it's spread across, the decision making spread across more people now. And I know we want to try and get the right decision, but in actual fact, my good instinct at the moment is that we actually go back to giving the referee a little bit of power, let him make decisions quickly. Obviously, with the use of images from replays, etc., but not spread it out as we're kind of doing at the moment, where the referee sometimes is the man in the firing line and he's relying on others to make good decisions. I don't know the right answer to that, but at the moment it's broken, our ability to officiate, and there's a huge amount of pressure on referees, but they're not backed enough to actually be able to make a call themselves. And also, they're spreading out. There's only maybe 10 or 12 top referees in the game, but you're diluting their power as well by spreading it across a big team. And it's not the decision like last night, like Dan Jones is now in the one to fire night, you know what I mean? But yes, and Bruzo is also, like, he's going to be hammered for it. But yet, as a team, I felt they made a mistake. They made a mistake, obviously, which happens. But I would rather the match referee have power over that, and we accept that there will be mistakes. I just don't think. I think it's getting worse. And I'm speaking to players and coaches every week, and they're going into games now, like, with absolutely no faith that they're going to get a good refereeing performance. And that's causing anxiety and stress and crankiness and back chat and all those things you don't want to have in the game. And the players don't trust the process. And you could argue the process has been proved correct because Tyburn gets off. That's fine. But what they care about is the 80 minutes to get their process right.
Yeah, and like I don't have the numbers to back this up right now. I'm completely going off gut feeling, but it does kind of feel like referees are more inclined to give the yellow card now and just pass it off to a foul play review officer in the bunker, rather than even, never mind trying to figure out is it yellow or red in the moment, figuring out whether if it's penalty only or yellow. It seems to be, I can give a yellow here at no major cost and someone else can make the final decision.
Yeah, I back that on my gut as well, that
we're seeing cards, more of
the yellow cards are going up. They're deferring the decision making to somebody else. I don't think that's. I don't know what the fans I spoke to. Not just this week. This is obviously this isn't just an Irish thing. Like, because Ty Byrne got sent off, I think this is what I see and hear from fans and through messages on Instagram and all that stuff, is that there's a feeling that the system is broken at the moment. And again, that's fine. We just need to try and correct it and try and make it better.
And
I do think on that, though, that I think they were trying to bring something like this in so that they wouldn't miss stuff.
Yeah.
And then they've actually created this whole, they've created, all of these problems by actually trying to fix something, and they've made it worse. Like, and then you have the incident in Cable Clark where he smashes Tommy O'Brien. It's a missed time challenge, in my opinion. He gets an arm to the face. There's a high degree of force in that, but that's not even looked at. It's a penalty. You know, I think that's something that the lack of consistency, it's creating a lack of consistency because there's too many minds, there's too many people making decisions in those moments. And it should just be, you have to, and referees are human, they're going to make mistakes, but allow them understand the feel of a game there and then and make a decision on that in that moment, I think is something that we need to completely agree with, which we need to get back to. But there just seems, in them trying to fix a problem, they've created more issues and it's less of a spectacle.
On this, I think the TMO and the foul play TMO, they now are probably the most important people in on a match day, because the big decisions are going to defer to them. And yet, if you look at the profile of some of the people that have been put in those positions, they're not massively experienced officials. Dan Jones has a limited amount of experience, hasn't been really at test level for a long period, etc. I actually would say that if you are going to not change it and give power back to the referee, that those foul play TMOs or TMOs should be some maybe the older experienced referees, test referees from the past,
took the words out of my mouth,
who now can't meet the athletic requirements, right? So an Alan Lewis, an Nigel Owens, etc., those type of people who've actually been in that seat, have seen a huge amount of rugby and can actually go, look, that doesn't, I know there's a protocol I got to go through here, but that incident, that's different than someone, if Gary Ringrose flies out of line and hits a player high, right? Like he did.
Like in Wales.
Like he did, yeah, exactly. I'd have no issue with him being red carded or whatever. But this incident here, I think my viewing of it was that basically Bodenbard kind of overran the ball, and Tyburn is in a situation where he thinks the ball's going to go out the back, and at the last minute he puts his hands up to protect himself, which happens, and ends up having head contact. So again, I would say an experienced referee who's seen that before could say, look, that's a rugby incident, move on.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's a good point, Birch, in terms of that, because technically, defensively, you tell your players if someone's running short and ball goes out to push off them,
exactly,
to physically push off them. And then in that moment, he gets caught. When you look at it and you analyze it, like, you're physically telling, or your coaching, defensive coach will tell them, we push off and push through. Mm. So you physically push someone off and get past. So in that moment, because he's in front of the ball, can't get the ball, it creates that collision, you know?
The circumstances of the red card and needing 3 minutes of replays for us on TV before anyone else in the stadium got a chance to see it. Pierre, we say, having to go down to the touchline to check it on a small little monitor. One of the many things on the day that just kind of seemed amateurish about the whole organisation, as you said, you were there, you were on commentary for New Zealand TV, but the issue with the stadium replays, even not even just TV production things, but like the New Zealand anthem, by all accounts, was fairly butchered. The stadium ran out of Guinness. I saw someone sent me a photo of the queue for the toilets. I don't know, did you see that one as well?
No, I didn't see that.
It was like thousands of people trying to queue into the gates of heaven. The pitch was brutal. The markings were still there from the NFL. It was a small pitch as well. It was really, really hard, like contributed to Jordy Barrett picking up what looks like a pretty bad, bad bruise on his knee. I'm not speaking as someone who's jealous he wasn't there, by the way, but, you know, and no one's going to take out the tiny violins for you being there
but it
did seem like the whole thing was poorly set up for what should have been a huge advertisement and a push towards a World Cup in 2031.
Yeah, I actually feel sorry. I think the RFU, Kevin Potts did a brilliant interview last week where he explained kind of their vision and that they believe that Ireland and the All Blacks have the potential to help this World Cup be successful, because obviously the expat community, Irish fans will travel, and then the All Blacks are probably the only rugby brand in America that has landed. You know, whether that's through the haka, whether it's through the jersey, you know, All Black, whether it's through the history and legacy of being one of the most successful sporting teams, elite level in the world across all sports. Mm-hmm. They were running a leadership conference last week for 350 people in Chicago. Like, they do have gravitas there, all right? And Ireland have a potential to grow it as well. So I really admire the RFU's plan, and I think Kevin Potts has said that they're going to go there every year now until the World Cup. That's certainly the plan.
And that's kind of why these things have to be spoken about
for sure,
now.
For sure, but I got anything that I saw the All Blacks or the RFU do last week was spot on, was top notch. But unfortunately, I don't know who was actually in control of the stadium and the game, and that was totally unacceptable. That was a massive opportunity missed. It didn't help the stop-start nature of the game, the errors, the injuries, the red card, etc. But that has to be boxed off and has to be ready. And I was lucky enough, so like my director, the TV director from Sky Sports New Zealand, like I could have sensed from his, because he's in my cans, even from the warm-up, it was difficult for him to get the footage that he wanted from the cameraman. So my good instinct is that a lot of those camera people have no experience of rugby, right? And you could say, yeah, a good cameraman can do their job, should be able to do everything. Yeah, they should be, but unfortunately, obviously, we've seen at the weekend, like the footage that the viewers at home were getting was the same footage I was getting on my screen, and it just wasn't how you would watch a rugby match.
There's an act to knowing what's the best way to look at a scrum.
Yeah.
Where do you want the camera to be looking into a ruck for? You know, like a ball grounding incident, like we saw with the second New Zealand try, trying to just be in the right position for those sort of things. It did seem like on quite a few big moments that the replay offerings were quite poor.
Yeah,
and people will give out to the TV companies about that, saying why aren't you showing me this or showing me that? Ultimately, it's kind of not really them who's deciding.
If they have 12 angles to pick from, right? They can only pick the best of those 12. So I think what we saw was the best of what they were given, but they weren't fit for purpose. And I suppose I only realised how bad I was, to be honest. I stopped looking at my screen. I just watched the game. So I only realised when I watched it back how how badly served the viewers were at home. And then obviously people in the stadium had no idea. They didn't know that Tyburn had a 20-minute red. They didn't know how long was left on that. They didn't know someone was coming back on. There was all kinds of nonsense that, in terms of the stadium announcer, was a bit clueless. And just the whole thing. Of course, the content of the match was poor as well until the last 20 minutes when New Zealand opened up a little bit. But yeah, given the hype and given the excitement, it did disappoint, really. And that happens in sport, you know. But obviously, what we can control is the stadium production, the quality of the camera angles, etc. And that'll be the, obviously, look, they've learned learnings. They learned from that. But the next game, you would be shocked if someone isn't brought in to make sure that that's spot on. Because it's an opportunity missed. 2025, 6 years from the World Cup, a sellout stadium, Soldier Field, two iconic teams. And I don't think that we capitalise on that in terms of the opportunity to show the game off.
And it seems that it kind of came across in the atmosphere, Birch, that all of that there was a bit of, like, you comment, like, at 55 minutes yourself and Marshall, you go, the game is dead. It seems like completely dead here. You know, like, there's nothing going on. And just watching the New Zealand stuff, like, for you to say that in comms with 25 minutes to go is like, Jesus, like, it must have been. And it seemed that all of those production issues, be it, you know, people not knowing, it affected the atmosphere then. And the game was still really tight at that stage. Like, it was in the melting pot with 25 minutes to go, which is, I know, hadn't been a great spectacle. But, you know, sometimes games like that, tension and tightness can create a bit more of an atmosphere. And it just seemed that, you know, watching it was like all of those production issues seemed to contribute to the poor atmosphere that was there.
Good trip all the same.
Ah, look, it's a great city. It's a great city. Phenomenal. And the amount of Irish ex-players that were floating around. So you Conor Murray, Rory Best, Kilcoyne, Jordy Murphy, Zeebo launches whiskey, Dennis Fogarty, Barry Murphy, Andrew Trimble. It was bananas. Yeah. It was class. And every Irish fan, and actually loads of listeners who listen to this, who live in America, this is where they get their rugby fix. This is rugby, RT Rugby Pod. So it was lovely to catch up with some of them, catch up with some diehard American rugby fans who are just so happy to have a test match of this nature in their country, and hope that it's like fellas coaching, you know, under 10s in a park. You know, they don't have the facilities, but they're absolutely passionate about rugby. And so I'm all in favour of these test matches being played there. The next time, I just hope that the whole thing is wrong. But Chicago is a city, Soldier Field is a stadium. I know the pitch wasn't great, but I don't know. I was in there Friday for the captain's run, and there's something historic and iconic about it as well. I think it was the right thing to do, and hopefully next time they get a lot more of it right.
Yeah, and there will be a next time, and plenty of next times over the next few years leading up to that World Cup. Learnings for everyone, I think, is what we can take away from that. Specifically, learnings for Ireland. I think you can gauge an Ireland performance very well off how Andy Farrell reacts. In my experience, he's generally a lot more critical of the team when they win. When they lose, he kind of pulls the shield up a little bit, tries to go into protective mode. It was very, very stark, I thought, that after the match, how critical he was of the team. Like, brutally honest was the word in how they needed to be looking at themselves. Well, like, looking at the performance, not specifically themselves or anything like that. I'm not talking about attitude, but performance. Brutally honest was the way he described it. I was out at the High Performance Centre yesterday where they were doing their media. Pretty similar message from the players and Johnny Sexton as well about what sounds like a pretty honest review that they would have had on Monday or Tuesday morning, looking back at the game as well. The only other time I can really remember Farrell being like that after a defeat was actually after the Lions played in the Aviva against Argentina as well. And obviously they got a solid reaction off that a little bit. You can't even use the 20-minute red card as an excuse for what happened in that game, because if anything, that was actually Ireland's best period of the match. It's going to be really interesting to see what sort of a response they get this week, and particularly next week and the week after.
Yeah, I think Farrell is a straight shooter, to be fair to him. And to be honest, I went to Chicago probably thinking that the All Blacks just had a little bit more at this moment, given the fact that they were battle-hardened. And then I spoke to Farrell and I spoke to some of the other coaches and some of the players on Friday, and they were locked in. Like, they were so confident. They'd had an unbelievable prep. Their training had gone super well, apparently, and they were ready. And the whole emotional thing and getting away in Chicago in 2016, all those things were... I was convinced talking to them that that was going to get them back to the team we know they can be. And then, obviously, they didn't happen. They were very inaccurate. They got lost quite a bit in attack, and they never really asked questions. Like, the Tadhg Furlong try was good, but it was just power and Gibson Park doing what he does. But anything outside of that, like up the field further, bar the play that led to the penalty to the corner, where we were sharp down the blind side off a contestable like James Lowe, regathered. In general, our phase and our set-piece attack was poor. Now, the set-piece attack doesn't help if your scrum is poor and your line-out malfunctioned the way it did. So I can understand that. But we had opportunities to counter-attack. We had opportunities in transition off turnover where we never really looked like the Irish team that we associate with Andy Farrell and his attacking ways. Now, I wasn't sure whether Ireland were going to evolve and not try and be that high phase count team. My impression from what I'm hearing is that that was the plan to be the team of old, and to go and take on New Zealand ball in hand with some kicking, but not be afraid to go play and have all those tight shapes that Ireland are famous for. We didn't see any of that, but I think the plan is to play that type of a game. So,
go back to the style that worked really well in 22-23.
It seems that when they're talking about their attacking game having been really sharp at training, my understanding of it is that that's what they wanted to do, okay? Now, they didn't do it. And again, the game was stop-start. They did have a high kick strategy and that worked at times. And just worked less in the second half. They kicked the ball away three times in the opposition 22, which was three possessions that could have, like, or in the right area of the field, if that makes sense, without a penalty advantage. And then, as I said, there's opportunities like the Jamie Osborne knock on that short line where you're kind of on top of New Zealand and he holds on to that and then you see what Ireland are going to do attack-wise. But the reality is, taking away the fact of what I was told from people I trust, if you judge it on 80 minutes, it was quite a poor attacking performance by Ireland. Mm-hmm. It was quite a poor set-piece performance by Ireland. And I would say it was quite a poor defensive performance by Ireland, right? So how we were in the game with 20 minutes to go is a bit of a miracle. But it's not really a miracle. It's down to the fact New Zealand were very, very average. Yeah. Like, Justin Marshall beside me was blown away by how poor they looked, right? But then, in fairness to them, they only need a tiny amount of ball to hurt you. Because they have so much X factor, so much power, so much pace. And unfortunately, we didn't have that on the day. So we needed lots
of
ball.
And a big bench.
Unbelievable bench. And in fairness, when you compare that, if you compare those individuals to Irish individuals, I don't think we won't have anyone on the bench like Wallace Atiti. Mm-hmm. You know, we don't have that profile in our game. We don't have anyone to start like Wallace Atiti. In terms of what he can do, we have brilliant players, but not like him. So that's the fear that's the challenge for Farrell now is over the next 2 weeks to refine that and find out why it didn't happen and make sure it happens against South Africa and Australia, or else we'll be 1-4. Like, realistically, if we play that badly again, I don't think we have any right to beat South Africa or Australia. Mm-hmm. And World Cup rankings don't matter. We're going to be in the top six regardless. Yeah. But it would be a big burst to our confidence based on the back of a kind of a pretty average Six Nations as well. Pretty average November last year. So then you're in a bit of a rut. But hopefully we can get it right. I trust these coaches to get it right.
Johnny,
moments you mentioned there, Bert, like, if you look at the ones where Jamie Osborne short ball turnover, the other one where we kicked the ball away, chip for Tommy O'Brien turnover, they're kind of nearly 14-point swings each because... the next phase, when New Zealand get the ball back, within 90 seconds to 2 minutes, New Zealand score. So it completely flips the momentum when it is in that, as you say, it's all kind of linked into your kind of comment of 55 minutes when, you know, the game is a bit dead. The game is lost in that kind of
Yeah.
the preceding kind of 10 minutes within those kind of moments where if Jamie can hold on to that ball, get a line break, get his hands free, or a half break line free, it completely changes the complexion of the game. They kick down, Crowley tries to run out, gets caught, and then you have the bench that comes on, and you know, Sam is trying to push it, throws an intercept over top. You know, the last try leads to from Bundiaki, who's forcing it, trying to play from their own. So it's that kind of mis-executed, I suppose, not mismanaged, because they're in the right area of the park, but it's the lack of execution in those moments. The chip through, the knock on, then another kind of grubber through to try, like those kind of massive moments where Ireland are playing on top, and to get into flow, they don't execute, and they just completely flips into 14 point swings.
Yeah, but Johnny, the thing is, the opposition needs to kind of find superiority in three successive moments to score, right? So yeah. If you think about the Jamie Osborne knock on, it's a good line, right? It's a knock on, that happens, right? But then, like, they kick the ball downfield. So Ireland need to deal with that, right? Ireland don't. We don't get bodies to the breakdown. Jack gets caught. They get over it. Then they kick to the corner. Then our line-up maul defence. Sorry, we give away a penalty at the line-up maul, right? So that's effectively 3 errors in a row. Four, actually, in this situation. Because they got, yeah, because then there's another penalty. And then they played a quick tap. And there's missed tackle on Satiti, I think, which means they're half a metre from our line, and we can see the try. The one, the kick over the top for Tommy O'Brien, it's not, I don't think that's an error. But the ball is knocked on, okay? So that's the error, right, by Tommy. From the scrum, they absolutely push it off the ball on their ball. Yeah. And I think Roygaard thinks he's a penalty advantage, which he should have had, right? But the ball comes out. He throws a pass over the top to Caleb Clark, right? So our defence there, We give him the edge. They take the edge. He's down the field, chips it over the top, and a minute later, or sorry, a phase later, Gary jumps out of the line. Yeah. Bowden Barrett.
And there are actually numbers on there.
There were numbers
on.
If he makes exactly.
that tackle, the numbers on. So the like, if he makes that shot, accelerates, hit that. That's a contact behind the gain line. James Lowe then gets too far ahead of the ball, so he gives him his shoulder, his inside shoulder, and they're gone. So like, though, but they're 3-on-3 there.
Yeah,
make your contacts. You know.
But my point is that there's effectively 3 errors in a row. Then.
So you're right. Yeah, exactly.
So that's the issue. You're going to make errors, right? So you're going to. The Jamie Osborne knock on is going to happen, but you can't let them not be able to resource that book, or if they kick to the corner, not be able to defend that without giving away a penalty. It's very easy to say that, but that's effectively the reality of it. So, and unfortunately,
but it's something this Ireland team were very, very good at for several years. And a one-off error was a one-off error. There weren't four one-off errors following each other.
100%, and that's where we need to get back to. We need to get back to that, and. Maybe the lack of game time. Like, unfortunately, I think we all thought maybe the lack of game time would mean we started slowly. Mm-hmm. We actually started okay. Yeah. We started okay, and we actually played quite a controlling type game. But when they got momentum and they went for the juggler, which I think was an example, was that Roygaard pass to Caleb Clark. Just our confidence was up then. They said we're going to go play. I thought then we were just hanging in there. I actually think it was another 5 or 6 minutes. Or 10 minutes, that game could have been 50 points. Like that, we just looked out on our feet. So is that the game time? Is that the game time? Or is that an old team? That'll be the question that Farrell
has. It is really difficult to actually... It can be very easy after that to go, oh, Lions hangover.
Yeah.
And obviously it's a very, very intrusive thought, because so many players coming off a very arduous season into a Lions tour and into a season very, very lightly raced coming into this game, they fall apart late on. Yes, you're obviously going to think Lions hangover, but the more you think about it, you kind of go, well, this happened against France and the Six Nations as well. Ireland were very, very sluggish 12 months ago in the autumn. I think we're actually going to need even more evidence to see whether or not this is a Lions hangover, or if this is actually a deeper, wider problem.
Yeah, and one of Ireland's best players wasn't on the Lions tour, Stuart McCluskey. Mm. You know, so it's...
But also, Bert, on what you're saying, you know, about them going back to the Ireland of old and playing on, you know, and really pushing those shapes and stuff, is it a case that they potentially need to take a step back to go back forward to that? So they need to be a bit more conservative, and not conservative, but a bit more carry orientated in the front line to control the ball and control the ball for longer, so you don't kick away those opportunities when you're on top. You know, you don't force those offloads. McCluskey had one on the wider side where he offloaded into touch with his arms free. You control the ball a slight bit more, which is 5 to 10% more conservative on what they want. Or do you just double down and go, well, we're going to be top six anyway. Let's build here and just double down and push through and go and get back to where we were and accept the pain that's going to happen sometimes.
Yeah, I think, Johnny, the challenge is going to be the game is actually different now 2 years later than it was in 2022-23. And you heard Sexton talk about the rewards for contestables, mm-hmm. you know, and that's a fact. That's a fact. And if you watch England against Australia, they score two tries from...
But that interpretation is 12 months old now. And Ireland have been really, really slow to kind of... Everyone else seems to be a little bit further down the road in how they're interpreting.
Yeah, well, they are. Well, if you look at England, how they're set up now... They're set up, and they're a different profile of players, to be fair. They've got a lot of power and pace in their team at the moment. But that the challenge is going to be to get the balance right between playing that contestable game, which is so important, but then being able to spring into life and be a phase play team. And that will take a little while. And you know, you've a halfback combination, we're still growing as a partnership, whether that's Gibson Park and Crowley, or Gibson Park and Prendergast, or whatever, or Casey and Prendergast, which might be this weekend. So that's just going to take a little bit of time. And I feel sorry for our halfbacks at the moment, because I think, you know, Test rugby at the top level between those tier one countries is like trying to play chess at 1,000 miles an hour. Like, it is hard, and so much of what we expect from our tens is based on what Sexton was able to do, which he's a generational type player, and not only him but very few players could have impacted the way we play that phase play like he has, right? In terms of decision making, in terms of attention to detail, in terms of understanding what pass to play and what the accuracy to play it, when to carry, when to kick, when to run. So that's hard for our tens at the moment to play that. So I think, and again, that's just part of what, if we want to be there in 2077, we're going to have to go through that, and they're going to have time in the saddle, and we're going to have to adapt. So maybe we should be really patient with Ireland. But unfortunately, the backdrop, Neil and Johnny, is that there's a lot of noise about the age profile. There's another, you know, so when you're like, when Farrell did his first season after Joe, it was, as he would say, clunky, right? And then suddenly it all just bedded in, and then it built and built and built. And I've no doubt he can do that again. But unfortunately, in the back of your mind, you're thinking about age profile of players and where will they be in 2 years' time? And are they still going to be the same players they were? And if they aren't, are we now missing a chance to try and find the next generation? That's all the noise in the background. Because there's no doubt that a lot of our best players and generational players, their age profile will be against the norm in 2 years' time. But if this Irish system with central contracting and player management has the value that we're told it has, there's no reason why we can't get them there, you know. But unfortunately, these are things we have to ponder as we watch Ireland play.
Well, let's continue on that subject then, and kind of lead into potential changes for this weekend against Japan. We're obviously expecting there will be a handful, but Farrell's kind of caught between a rock and a hard place now with how poor that game against New Zealand was. There is a temptation that, there are some players now that kind of have to be played back into form a little bit. Mm. And I feel like maybe there might be one or two fewer changes than there might have been planned a week ago. The other part to look at it is, I think we kind of spoke about it last week, about how hard it is to actually break into this Irish team. And Farrell is very, very loyal to his players, and that's a brilliant thing in many, many respects. But of this weekend's team to play Japan, which we don't even know yet, of the players who are given an opportunity, how well do they have to play to be given another opportunity next week against Australia for the form to be rewarded, for Farrell to go, do you know what, I'm going to stick with the hot hand here? Does it have to be 10 out of 10?
They'd have to be very good, and he'd have to have serious doubts around some of the established players that they're not going to get back. I think I think they deserve another crack, a lot of them, in against South Africa, because they are the best. They are the best. Like, that's the challenge, is when we're watching URC, we're watching Champions Cup, like, I'm not sure how many players outside of that squad that he's picked actually could go in and help you beat the All Blacks. That's, maybe I'm wrong. Maybe I'm wrong. Maybe a John.
But sometimes do you have to find that out?
Maybe. Yeah. No. Look, that. But you'll only find it out in the Irish model if there's another big underperformance, I think, and that won't be this weekend. They might be clunky and stuff against Japan, but I think it's the box test is the one.
Yeah, I think that's that is the litmus test where they're going to decide where things, you know, kind of change or not. But I don't think there's going to be wholesale changes over the next, you know, the next couple of weeks, or someone's going to drop down. Like, I don't see, you know, someone like Tom Farrell usurping Gary Ringrose or even Bundy Aki, you know, like, so it is the, I think the, it all leads to kind of the South African kind of test in terms of where they are. And that's where you're probably going to see a proper ranking score and where they go.
But I would like to see Tom Farrell play, though. You know, I'm just like, I would like to see Tom Farrell play this weekend.
But in the broader sense of building the squad depth, are we kind of backing ourselves into a corner here? Where in if you look at the amount of players who have made debuts, and even take away the summer when there was just an enormous amount of players that made debuts, but even over the last few years, there have been like a very, very impressive number of players who've got opportunities and got in, and many of them have played well in the opportunities they've had. But the opportunities are only ever coming against Japan or against Fiji or against Georgia or again, maybe an odd game against Italy in a Six Nations. There has to be an injury for one of these players to have that form rewarded against an Australia or South Africa or New Zealand or one of the bigger Six Nations teams. Like, use Tommy O'Brien as an example. Really, really impressive in the summer. Form has been excellent for Leinster for the guts of a year now since he came back from his injury. Played on Saturday, had a solid enough game. I think like everyone had some good and bad moments as well. If he plays brilliantly the next couple of weeks, is he starting a Six Nations game if Mac Hansen is fit?
Up to now, you'd say no. You'd say it's unlikely, because I think Andy Farrell has been incredibly loyal. But I think that's a good thing. And I also think... he's been rewarded by the fact that Mac Hansen, just use him as an example, and James Lowe and all those players have generally performed for him. I've no doubt that coaching staff of Farrell, O'Connell, Easterby, Sexton, Goodman, Fogarty, they have the capacity to be ruthless, and will make the call, but they'll make the call based on a couple of underperformances rather than one. Farrell is loyal, but he's well able to make big calls, and they'll make them if they have to. So now the challenge is for those frontline players is to step up. And I think now Lions tour, long holiday, limited preparation going into it. Chicago, 10 days in Chicago, a match, another week here, whether you play against Japan or not, there's absolutely no excuse not to be match ready for South Africa and Australia. Like, they've been in camp for a good while that stage. They've had enough pre-season into them, game time. And I think the reality is that if they don't perform against South Africa, Australia, he'll have no choice, because he'll have to make a call then, because obviously if you only get caps into the Tommy O'Briens or whoever else you see coming in, they're going to have to play Six Nations, because you want to have them 15 caps plus and be established in the team by the time you go to Australia. So I think this is a massively important month for a lot of our best players to wear an Irish jersey.
How do you see that, John? Like, do you think the good performances against the smaller nations are rewarded enough long term?
Probably not, but like, he has built, you know, they got to number one in the world and went on that streak with a lot of guys there, so he has that loyalty. But I 100% agree with Bert that he there has to be a change if there isn't a performance over the next 3 weeks by those individuals. And then you know, you have to give people exposure to those moments of real high intense pressure in melting pot games. be it in, in Twickenham in France, and then build up, through summer tours in terms of being away for a long time, being in camp, getting used to all of that. I think it's so important that those guys are given that time, to be able to do that. A lot is going to be decided over the next couple of weeks, but you look at all the people that went to Georgia and Portugal. I know it was very different. The limited number of those guys that are potentially going to feature over this period of time. Stuart McCuskey has come back in. He was on that tour, but he was there before and he's been in and out for a while. So he's rewarding old, he's rewarding form of someone that he knows, understands, and trusts has played in big games. So I think it is going to be harder for those younger guys of the age bracket of 23, 24, 25 to break in unless the performances really do drop over the next, well, it's this month for those guys.
Of the starters last weekend, how many do you think are still going to be there this weekend? Either in Tadhg Burns' example that unfortunately got his red card, he probably actually needs the game in there as well. And then others maybe that need to be played back into form a little bit.
Yeah, I'd say Bundy could do with a hit out. He doesn't look match sharp. Didn't for Connacht's first game. Didn't look his usual self coming off the bench, so he'd probably play. I'd imagine Paddy McCarthy will play. I'd say Kelleher will play. Finney probably play.
Get the front rows, you would imagine.
Yeah, mm-hmm. Yeah. Would Timoney get a shot? It would be good to see him get a shot. Casey get a shot. I don't know why he's going to do a 10, because if he doesn't play Sam this game, maybe he doesn't play at all, I would say. So probably play Sam with Jack coming back in, or Jack on the bench and Jack coming in against South Africa. He also won't want to make too many changes, and he'd want to have
you probably want to give Caelan Doris a start to build up those minutes ahead of South Africa.
Yeah, so I think it'd be a fairly strong team. Mm-hmm. It'd be a fairly strong team, and yeah, it'll be fascinating. It is the ideal game for them. Ideally, you'd have played Japan before you played New Zealand, and you go New Zealand, South Africa, Australia. But now they're going to have to be ruthless and put in a big performance.
We mentioned Stuart McCluskey, Johnny, and he's the only real injury doubt coming into this week. He was also arguably the best player for Ireland in that first 55 minutes before he went off. I was nearly relieved to find out afterwards that I think it kind of goes along with the poor production of the day, that it wasn't until after the match anyone really knew he was carrying a knock afterwards. At the end of that game, I was thinking, oh my God, what is he doing taking Stuart McCluskey off at this stage? It's so early, he was playing so well. I actually was slightly relieved to find out he had a knock, and it just wasn't a very bizarre decision. I don't know where you stand on McCluskey. He's the only real injury doubt this week. Personally, I don't, like, if he is carrying even a minor knock, I don't want to see him anywhere near the team this week. I would be saying to him, you had a great game last Saturday. Put your feet up this weekend. Get right. You're starting against Australia. You have that lockdown. That's a decision made. That's your reward for Saturday. I don't know how you feel about that.
Yeah, I'd be 100% in agreement. I think he's done enough now, and he's been on the back foot. He's pushed through, showed incredible resilience and fight to get back into the reckoning. And I think in terms of it fits the narrative of that, Bundy needs some time, some game time, rest up, start, and then make a call based on performances then for the final game in the series. So, I think he is picking a form team. He is certainly the form 12. It's who sits and who fits outside him for the games, really. But then I suppose Gary Ringrose needs a bit of time. So that's kind of where they get that balance and act. Right, not this week, but the following week then as well.
It's interesting, Birchak. I think there's actually enough evidence on Stuart McCluskey now to get a firm belief that his best performances from Ireland come against the better teams.
Yeah, not for sure.
He is a big game player.
Yeah, he is. And he was on the stormer against South Africa, wasn't it, a couple of years ago? Yeah. And had to go off early.
After 20 odd minutes.
Yeah. The only thing I would say is,
I think he had like 9 tackles in 25 minutes or something like
and
that.
And he gets your gain line.
Yeah.
The only thing I would say, if you look at a profile of the back line. So Stewart's not really a playmaker. He's a guy who gets you go forward, and obviously you need those as well. Gary's playmaking ability probably is not where it was, I would say. I think he's become more of a direct type of player. He's not bringing many players into the game with him. Jamie Osborne, a fullback, he's not a natural playmaker. You know, Hugh Keenan had developed that highly. So I think it's hard on Jack Crowley as well. If Ireland are trying to play this multi-phase game, if he doesn't have another layer and a second playmaker. And how Ireland used to do it before was obviously Keenan was in the team, but Sexton used to play out the back of Bundy quite a bit. So again, you had your playmaker a little bit wider out. But Ireland are going to have to figure that out. Like when you look at that, you look at the profile of the backs we have without Keenan, and we just don't really seem to have balance to players across the back line who are going to bring others into the game.
Mm-hmm. I think that's why someone like Mac Hansen is so important in life, and Farrell loves him so much because he gives you that second play. Sure. You look at, even in the World Cup and stuff, like he's popping in behind shapes and kicking cross fields from the middle of the pitch. And he's just so active in behind those shapes. He's never really on his wing. When he is on his wing and he gets the ball, he'll finish or he'll create something. I think he gives you that, you know, old school kind of 12, second 5'8 Kiwi style guy. He's not in the center, but he's very, he is very active and pops up in those places. And he gives you that I suppose, comfort for a 10, that knowing that, okay, well, we have him. And if he's calling in behind shapes, he's organizing those shapes. He gives us that direction that they need in this. Yeah, I think in that Goodman's attack, I think Birch, as you say, needs that second receiver to be able to really light it up. And the profile, look at Tommy O'Brien, he doesn't give you that, you know, this weekend.
Yeah.
They don't have that really, you know.
I think Tom Farrell does bring others into the game. He's not your stereotypical second playmaker, mm-hmm. but he does link pretty well. He has that outside break. He does play heads up rugby, so potentially he will help out.
That ability to kind of like push off a player and get the arms free, exactly. and bring players in.
Yeah.
To follow on the theme of the, I suppose, the premium of X factor players in the Ireland squad, and I think it kind of goes hand in hand with the line out, which kind of didn't get round to earlier on, but I do think is worth talking about, because if you don't have the X factor players and the game breakers and the people who can just make something from nothing happen 60 metres out from the try line, Ireland are a team that rely a lot on the line out for their attacking opportunities and laying the platform for scoring tries. 11 out of 16 at the weekend, at 69% return, 6 out of 10 in the first half, which I think is even more crucial, because that was the period of the game where Ireland had the best opportunities. If you're relying on the line-out more than any other part of your game, it has to be world-class. It has to be top two or three line-outs in the world, in the game. But it's becoming a vicious cycle with Ireland at the moment, where the more your line-out looks under pressure and looks vulnerable, the more teams are going to go after it and put you under even more pressure.
Yeah, and it just, the very first one...
It's, you putting, know, a target on yourself.
Yeah, I think O'Connell would be so disappointed with our ability to be accurate. Like the very first line of the game, I don't know if you saw it on TV, but there was no jump.
I played with the Terran Your Fifths earlier on Saturday afternoon, and we did not have a line out as bad as that.
Okay, right. Jesus. We'll have to get video evidence to actually verify that. But yeah, from the very first one where no one got in the air to a not straight to a lot of movement. And so then we panicked and went into triple movements, and the All Blacks have a very nice, very good defensive system where it's a mix between mirroring and block, and they seemed to let us, they didn't buy our dummies to the front, and were able to get up. Lord was exceptional off that. Fabian Holland's got great aerial range, and it just became an absolute cluster flip. And but unfortunately, against New Zealand, that's the third time in a row, you know, Paris, November last year. So they really have the hoodoo on us at that stage. But also, I think overall, I'd say Farrell would be expecting a lot more from our line out in general. And that's that's something we have to get right. We are a team who are based on, heavily based on our line-out attack, and if you're not 80% or more in that area, you're going to struggle. So yeah, we won't know this weekend. We know against South Africa, because they block off the middle and back, and we could easily have a high percentage there, because we can just take the front. But it's our ability to win, to be able to manipulate that space, middle and back, and win ball, I think would be a real, it'll be a real sign that we've made progress.
And Johnny, like, people will say, look, Tadhg Byrne, losing him, great, excellent line-out operator, line-out caller, that's a big blow. Obviously, it is over the course of a game, but I think you do have to point out the fact that that opening line-out where it looked like they'd met in the car 5 minutes before kickoff, Tadhg Byrne was still on the pitch at that point. The game was only 45 seconds old.
Yeah, I think that was, and you just get the sense of when something like that happens as a supporter, you go, oh, what's going on there? You know, like, it was... not getting anyone off the ground. It was just a complete, I don't know whether it was lack of communication, mix up on calls. I think it does have an effect on the game throughout not having him on the pitch. But then, you know, when you look at that incident and it's, you know, the set piece, and we spoke about the nines and tens. It's very hard for the nines and tens then as well to try and control any type of game when your set piece is creaking, and you're not getting that go forward. You're reliant on what a lot of teams are looking at as probably the third set piece on your kick return, when you're getting the ball and trying to launch in off kick receipt and transition. But it's, it is something that has to be so much better in terms of allowing us get into that launch, get into that multi-phase and try and break them in the first three phases. And if we don't break them, then get into, you know, 10, 11, 15 phases consistently throughout the game. And it just makes it so hard on everyone.
I'll try to finish up on a bit of a positive, because we've kind of got in hard enough this afternoon. Ryan Baird was, unfortunately, he was probably the player that didn't get off the ground for that opening lineout, but he's shown up now enough times at this stage that as a defensive line-out operator, he has really come on leaps and bounds in the last couple of years. Had two excellent steals at the weekend, both at really important opportunities. I know in the end it was ultimately all for nothing, but I suppose you don't forget those things. And when you think of what Ireland have lost in the last few months of Peter O'Mahony, the world-class defensive line-out operator, it was nice and refreshing to see kind of Baird take on a lot of that responsibility.
Yeah, and actually it feeds into, like, Paul O'Connell's getting quite a bit of criticism, right? And obviously the responsibility lies with him, but I think if you look at the profile of our locks over the last 6, 7, 8 years, we haven't developed an absolute line-out guru. We've tried lots, but, like, and this isn't, oh, back in my day.
But like Joe McCarthy's come through, but he's not a line-out.
Exactly.
He's not a pure line-out forward.
And again, like, his profile, you need him in the team or he's going to be very valuable. But, like, back in the day, whether it was Leo Cullen in Leinster, Paul O'Connell, Dunnick O'Ryan, etc., they were the line-out gurus. And whatever team they came into, they took on the line-outs and they worked with a coach. But they had the capacity in-game to just stay calm and execute and problem solve themselves, and that gave everyone else confidence. And this has been a long time since we've had an out and out lineout guru in our mix. You know, so if you had one like that, if you had a Devon Toner, right? Mm-hmm. Devon Toner was another one. For what he lacks in athleticism, he becomes very much valuable to the selection for the box game, because it's going to help the whole team get a higher percentage. And Ryan Baird, in fairness to him, wasn't an attacking or defensive lineout guru by any manner of means, but it's probably the last 2 years we've heard about his dedication, how he wanted to upskill himself, but the work he does, and you've seen that at Leinster level, where he's become a key defensive lineout menace for Leinster, and now you're seeing it at Ireland level. Mm-hmm. And again, like, if you only have a tiny player pool, we need to try and find somebody who can work with Paulie or whoever, or one in each province, where they are absolute specialists in that game, because all the other teams have them. It hasn't gone out of the game, but we just haven't created one who is, like, world class. Like, if I ask you who was responsible for line-outs at the weekend, do you know?
As in line-out caller?
Yeah.
I would have said Tadhg Byrne before the game.
Yeah, and after?
In-game.
In-game then?
I'm going to say, was it James Ryan straight afterwards?
No, I don't know.
Oh, but, right, yeah, sorry, yeah, I thought you had the answer.
Yeah, no, sorry, no, what I mean is that, no, I mean that's
yes,
that's a recent conundrum, you yeah. know, like often post game, who's calling Lennox? Like, we just don't have, it's spread, which is great, it's fine, it's fine, but I think it's because we don't have the out and out absolute guru mm-hmm. in our rotation. And if you base it on statistics and Saturday, that's, you have to factor it into the reason why we haven't been at the level we should be at or expect to be at.
Right, we'll keep an eye on those numbers over the next few weeks. Johnny, before we finish up, I do want to give you an opportunity to talk about where you're going this weekend. Tell us about the 7-4-5 game. I know you spoke about it last year as well, but for those who aren't familiar, a game and a cause that's pretty close to your own heart.
So I played in it last year. It's a game that came about when Ed Slater and Rob Burrow started to talk about trying to do something on the pitch. So we played in Headingley last year. It's a hybrid game, kind of half league, half union, more league really. And it's in aid of the Doddy Weir Foundation, Rob Burrow and Ed Slater Foundation. So Rob played 7, Ed was 4, I think Doddy was 5. So that's where that came from. And obviously with the news of kind of my old teammate Lewis Moody being diagnosed a couple of weeks ago, it's an opportunity to kind of support any type of fundraising for motor neuron disease to try and find a cure for what is an absolute, you know, it's a horrible disease. And it's something that we kind of, as you said, very close to my heart, and something that hopefully we can have a bit of crack on Sunday, kind of connections with, it's actually on TNT Sport, and try and, you know, raise as much money as we can for all of those foundations to go into research. They've raised a huge amount of money over, you know, the last number of years. And I think there's going to be a big fundraising drive from a Lewis, you know, from a Lewis perspective. I'll be doing something next year, hopefully try and get a number of Irish players that would have played with Lewis, be it through the Lions or Leicester at that time. So, yeah, just looking forward to a good day. It'll be like playing Lansdowne under 20s again, being playing rugby on a being hungover playing on a Sunday. The only difference is I won't have the fear chasing me around. It'll be someone like Keith Senior and those lads. So it'll be an interesting afternoon, but an emotional day, but an incredibly positive day in the circumstances to try and raise as much money as possible.
Yeah, it's like they're hugely important games, I think, at this stage, Bernard, because we are, unfortunately, we're kind of seeing more and more players who are having struggles and long-term health implications after the game.
Yeah, it's a great cause, and yeah, as you say, unfortunately, there's more names coming. Our names come out recently, and hopefully there'll be no more, but unfortunately, the likelihood is there is. So, yeah, as a community, we have to get together and try and make sure that their families are set up for life.
Yeah, so that's the 7-4-5 game. If anyone wants to find out a little bit more about it, just Google or search online the 7-4-5 game. You'll get all the results pretty quickly, and check in on, I suppose, Johnny Murphy's socials. You'll have posts over the next few days. Johnny, best of luck with it. Hope we hope we get to speak to you again soon, and you're not suffering too badly after it.
See you, Johnny.
As long as my knee gets through it, that's a win for me, to be perfectly honest.
Absolutely. A reminder, Ireland against Japan in the Quilter Nations series this Saturday from 12 p.m. on RT2 and RT Player. You can also follow a live blog on the RT News app and rt.ie/sport. And you can listen to live commentary of the game on RT Radio 1 Extra. We'll speak to you again soon.